From the WVXU studios, this is Cincinnati Edition.
We're going to take an aggressive approach to really tackling some of the issues in our schools that are keeping our kids from being safe. And so one of the major pieces that we're going to be tackling is bullying, and we're going to do it in an innovative way.
Cincinnati Public Schools Superintendent Laura Mitchell as the district faces a wrongful death lawsuit for a bullying-related incident. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news, and joining me this afternoon as we discuss this and other top stories, Cincinnati Inquirer health reporter Ann Saker, Inquirer political columnist Jason Williams, and WCPO economic development reporter Bob Driehaus. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good afternoon, everybody. Good to see everybody here today.
Thanks for inviting
me. Nice to be here.
Thanks
for having me.
Thank you for being here. And Jason, Cincinnati City Council has cleared the way for the expansion of Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And this was actually what they took a series of votes to do this, right?
Correct. This week, there was a series of votes on zoning and other related issues around the development for a $500 million dollar plus $550 million to $650 million expansion of Children's Hospital into Avondale. There also was a vote on there was a motion introduced kind of 48 hours before the main vote on the zoning by council members Wendell Young and Yvette Simpson that essentially asked for Children's Hospital to invest millions more into the neighborhood on top of money that they were going to put into the development and on top of extra $11.5 million that the hospital previously agreed to pour into the neighborhood. That sounds confusing. Sorry.
Well, and it was confusing. I think the point I wanted to make was this was not just one vote. This was actually a series of several different votes.
Correct.
That Children's had to clear before they could move forward with this project.
Yeah, it became a series of votes. It was originally pretty much set up to be a rubber stamp deal for council. But then again, at the last minute, two council members came in with essentially conditions that they were trying to put on the deal. I mean, council essentially had one big vote, and that was to approve the zoning for this expansion. But then on Monday at a committee meeting, the two council members came in and came with a list of demands and a new motion that said we want Children's to do more for the neighborhood than what they've already committed to do. And so that also became part of the vote, which ultimately – those conditions, which was an emotion, were voted down.
Yeah, and what was surprising about that was that the Children's wasn't coming asking for money at all. They just needed a zoning change to put 100% of their money into this project. So it really caught some people by surprise when the two council members tried to tie it to extra investment in the neighborhood.
Bob, can you clarify how big this project is in terms of the space, how much of the neighborhood this is going to have an impact on?
It's almost one city block. It's directly north of the existing hospital. It'll have a new ER and 10 floors of rooms. So it's a big project. And I just drove through the neighborhood yesterday. They're taking out some pretty nice old houses that they've acquired through private sales.
Yeah. How many homes are they going to be taking down?
It's 30 homes, which accounts for 0.5% of the housing stock in the entire Avondale neighborhood.
And when the hospital presented its packet of information to the Planning Commission to get their approval on their zoning request, they said between 5 and 8 families are going to be moved out of that neighborhood for this expansion, and that they have people at Children's Hospital who are helping those folks find other housing. To me, Mark, this is such a classic example of why we tell young cub reporters that covering zoning is a really important job in journalism, because big things happen in the fine print of zoning changes. And this is what's happened in this particular case, too. We have a gigantic project that's going to move one plus block into Avondale, and it's all come down to the zoning language. This has been fascinating for me as a healthcare reporter, because no one's arguing that Children's Hospital should not expand and should not have an opportunity to get bigger, because they are doing more pediatric medicine, more complicated pediatric medicine, and they need space to do it. The debate, originally they had talked about putting it on their own campus, as they did the 15-story science tower. They could build out in Butler County, where they have their campus, where the proton radiation unit is. There are only 25 of those in the country. But Michael Fisher and other folks at Children's Hospital have been saying all along they wanted to stay in Cincinnati, that that is important to them. The only place they felt they could do this medical decision in building this tower was in Avondale. And as we know, Avondale is unfortunately the sufferer of decades of racial discrimination and redlining and bad education and bad health care. And then this comes in, and the residents there push back. It was too much at once.
I think among the folks who aren't losing their homes, their argument was that they don't want to have parking lots, a big towering building, and the additional traffic and congestion that this could bring on.
I think if any of us have had the experience of a house going up next to us or a building going up on our block, we know what a hassle it can be to have that kind of construction in your neighborhood. This project is going to take at least 4 years. So imagine living next to that. And that's part of the problem.
And when it's finished, you won't have two-story houses next door to you anymore. You'll have a 10-story building.
Right.
So it's a real change. And I think part of talking to people in Avondale, it's because, to put it in context, nobody said, boy, we don't like Children's. But there are people saying, little by little, our residential space has been shrunk by the zoo, by Children's, by University Hospital, and they want to be more of the part of the conversation at the beginning.
Absolutely, yes.
Where and some folks, there's a lot of disagreement about this, but some folks feel like this was just sort of presented almost as a done deal, although the mayor and others say we had a lot of public hearings. Children says this too, and they feel like they did give people a chance to be part of the conversation.
I think if you look at it from the 50,000-foot view and taking into account the neighborhood's concerns, you look at what's happened in over the Rhine and there's certainly probably some concern that these developers, are they coming into our neighborhood and pushing people around or out the way it's happening over the Rhine? And I think, what's happened there has been wonderful, and it's probably gone about as well as it could have gone generally. But it's still very challenging for some people to be pushed out of your house. And so what you're seeing in Avondale right now is you're seeing some big-time development with the new Martin Luther King Jr. Interchange project at I-71. There's a ton of development planned around that, or that's potential around that. So that's right there in Avondale, right at the gateway of Avondale. And now you have Children's wanting to do this. Children's now, and how many expansions have they had? So then what about next time they want to expand? And what about the next time they want to expand? And
right.
Eventually, you take over 10 blocks or 4 blocks more,
right,
or whatever. And so the bigger picture of it is there's concern. And on the flip side, I don't think Children's, from my reporting anyway, could have handled this any better. From their standpoint, they certainly appears as if they did right by the community and had the proper amount of meetings and listened and paid or offered fair market value for the houses that they want to take or that they need to build this expansion. So certainly it's and Bob pointed out, they didn't ask for any money. That's pretty much unheard of.
Yeah, no public money.
They are spending this is a $500 million project. This is unheard of for, a big, large, and this is a nonprofit, of course, but, big, large company business to not ask for any public money. And on top of that, turn around and actually pay an additional $11.5 million to invest in neighborhood programming and projects.
And as far as the argument, this came out of nowhere. They actually started talking about this, 3 or 4 years ago?
Michael Fisher says, the CEO of Children, says 2014 is when it started, and he documented that in an 8-page letter to council this week. We've certainly seen other documents and that have surfaced in which there were talks in 2015 as well, and then again earlier this year there were it's in writing that there were at least six public meetings that Children's held with the neighborhood. I don't know if there were more beyond that, but that's at least what we know that's in writing.
Yeah. So where does this head next now that they've got this vote accomplished? Now they've cleared this particular hurdle. Where does this go next?
Construction starts this fall on the parking garage, and I believe on the actual patient tower next year. And there seems to be, at least Michael Fisher left us with the implication on Wednesday that he wants to continue talking with the neighborhood to see what else can be done. But this was the permission they needed to go forward on this. And I thought, on a certain level, we had a really extraordinary exercise in democracy this week by having this gigantic conversation taking place over what do we value in this city. And we value an important historic neighborhood, and we value what Children's Hospital brings to the table. And when they clash, we see an explosion, and it was sad to see that. It would have been nice to have everybody come to the table. It would have been a more boring story for us if everybody had come to the table and held hands to sing hymns, but that's not what happened. We had a pretty interesting fight over what's important to us here.
And it'll be interesting to see how Children's and Avondale respond going forward,
right,
now that a lot of this resentment and feeling of disenfranchisement really bubbled to the surface and got a lot of media attention this week.
Yes.
Not any chance they might change the design plans to make the neighborhood feel better?
No, I don't think so. It's the loss of the residents, the homes that I think people care about the most. So whether it's 10 or 8 stories, I don't think will matter much.
Right.
Jason, what about political fallout from this? Is this going to have any impact on the council race and the mayor's race?
It could. I mean, there's a lot of – I mean, I've talked to several people this week who come at this from different angles and who are smart political people and who watch this stuff closely. And the general consensus is that they don't know what Yvette Simpson was doing from a political standpoint.
And suggesting asking Children's for more money, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was referred to you know, by another councilman on another radio station as a shakedown. I certainly don't know if it was meant to be that way. I mean, you look at it, it was on paper that this request was made that they give an additional $16 million to $21 million, if doing the math. So what's challenging for Simpson is, like, you know, did she spend a lot of political capital on this? Mind you, Avondale is all – she won that going away in the primary. It's a solid part of her base, the neighborhood. And so and that neighborhood was seemingly fully behind her and happy with her and going into the November election. They'll continue to be, I believe. But people love Children's Hospital. How does Cranley use this? Is he able to message it as, like, oh, look at my opponent push back on new jobs and on helping children? Now, I mean, the people who know Simpson, like, she cares deeply about children and does a lot for children. But I'm just saying, politically, how is that going to play
as
a general electorate?
Yeah. We had a question from Twitter. Did Children's make any changes based on neighborhood requests?
Not that we know of. Yeah. They made some changes to the design to better satisfy the needs of the project itself. As far as we know, they haven't really made any alterations in to make the neighborhood happier. And that's kind of one of the things I think about a lot, which is, why was there no one to bring these parties together around the table, not just at a public meeting, but in some other forum to try and resolve? It just seems like these were problems that were solvable between the parties, and they didn't get solved.
Yeah, and the Twitter listener also asked, didn't the Avondale Community Council vote against this?
Yeah, yes, they did. They certainly did. Unanimously.
Very much opposed.
They came out, yeah, with saying that this was kingdom building rather than serving children, the president, really strong words against it.
Yeah. So, Anne, when's the work going to be finished? Do they have a
2021.
2021, but it's getting started pretty soon.
The construction is scheduled to begin in October, I believe.
And on another story, parents of an 8-year-old Westwood boy, he was a student at Carson Elementary School who committed suicide, apparently yes. after he was bullied. His parents are now suing Cincinnati Public Schools. What are they claiming in their lawsuit?
This is a federal lawsuit filed by the parents of Gabriel Taye, who died on January 26th, a suicide. And his parents alleged that Cincinnati Public Schools allowed a reckless and treacherous environment in the school that was becoming violent, and that Gabriel himself had suffered bullying incidents several times before the final incident on the 24th, where we saw this video where he apparently approached another boy in a restroom that was not monitored by adults, but there was a video camera focused on the entrance to the restroom, and Gabriel apparently was assaulted and was unconscious for at least 7 minutes. His mother said that the school called her. She took him to Children's Hospital. He was kept for 12 hours. She brought him home. He slept the next day, went back to school. The lawsuit claims there was another bullying incident in that morning. He came home that night and took his own life. And the parents are arguing in their lawsuit that this was a wrongful death that should have been prevented, and that Cincinnati Public Schools has a responsibility and should be held accountable for it.
And how's the school system responded to this, Anne?
They have extended their prayers and condolences to the family. They are no longer speaking about the case now that a lawsuit has been brought. But before the lawsuit was filed, the retiring superintendent, Mary Ronan, said that her belief was that he had simply fainted. And the school Carson Elementary has since lost its principal and assistant principal, I think largely because of the
lost.
Fallout.
Did they resign
this.
Or?
Mr. McKenzie, the assistant principal, has left CPS, and the principal asked to be moved to another school, and that's apparently in process now.
Mm-hmm. So what was Gabriel like?
Well, of course, when you talk to his parents, what you hear is a picture of a beautiful young man who was a song and singer and a dancer and wanted to be a soldier and joined the Army and was a friendly kid. And they told me repeatedly this week when I had the opportunity to speak to them, they had no idea that he was experiencing this level of bullying, that he was upset to go to school. His mother offered the poignant observation that perhaps he was trying to protect the bullies by not saying anything. His father said maybe he just thought this was what school was supposed to be, which is a heartbreaking thing to hear from a father.
Yeah.
I think we all understand that bullying is an ingredient of childhood. We would like to keep our children protected from it, but it is an ingredient. And I'm not sure we're at the point now where we have quite figured out how much is the school's responsibility, how much is the parents' responsibility, and where does the rest fall in between. The interesting thing to me is that covering this as a health issue, it's not entirely clear that bullying causes suicide. And that's unfortunately the leap we often make in these cases. Bullying can certainly be a risk factor for suicide, as we see in many instances. The question then becomes, does bullying push a child to the point of such despair that taking one's life is the best possible option, which is a critical place for a kid to go?
Now, who's representing the family in this suit?
The lead attorney is a woman by the name of Jennifer Branch here in Cincinnati. She is a partner of L. Gerhardstein, who I think folks will know the name. And the education lawyer is Carla Loon Leader in Loveland. And they are Jennifer Branch is the lawyer who signed off on the lawsuit.
How likely is this suit to prevail? How likely are they to succeed with this? Are these tough?
These are hard cases to take to trial. I've been trying to find a jury verdict. They generally don't go to juries for lots of reasons. It's an incredibly loaded emotional subject. It's hard to put that kind of a case to a jury. And I think mainly these become a question of how much responsibility does the school have? And these cases mainly go to settlement.
And
that's
probably
what will go to what will
just
happen
as
here.
A matter of public relations for CPS, they have a great motivation to settle, right, to try to get this out of public view.
I kind of thought they would before the suit was filed, because once, as everyone knows, once a lawsuit is filed, that's when you have the big cloud of media attention. And but at any rate, this is where we are now. We're going to let the courts handle it, and we'll see where we go from there.
Okay. Bob, FC Cincinnati is continuing its quest to build a new stadium for $200 million. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's $100 million that would come from the team. And then they're trying to get $100 million in public financing.
Right.
What kind of a stadium would taxpayers get for their $100 million?
So, they want to get a 25,000-seat stadium. It would be a European-style stadium, which means a single bowl rather than multiple vertical levels. Lots of suites, club seats. Big public gathering space outside the stadium so that the people can march in, which FC soccer fans in general like to do en masse. They want it in a dense urban environment, which is big for them. So they've looked at, at Newport, the West End, and Oakley as possible, the finalists at least at this point.
And I saw an article you did where you mentioned Forest Fair. Is that even – are they really thinking that? Is that even a possibility?
That's Dan Monk's article. Forest Fair pitched it to them. I can't imagine that – based on what Jeff Birding has said, they want that would be it, because that's very suburban. Like, there's no urban density there. There's nothing urban about that site. That said, it's got lots of easy access from 275, and it's a giant footprint that they're desperate to get something on because it never has worked as a mall the way they ever envisioned. But we'll see. But I can't imagine that it would end up out there.
Where did the $200 million price tag come from? How did that number come about?
They worked with an architect. They told them – Jeff told me
– Jeff Birding?
Yeah. Okay. The present CEO of FC Cincinnati. He told me that they worked backward. First, they said, this is what we need. We need this many seats, these features, et cetera. And then the architect said, that's going to run you $200 million.
So that's how they came up with the $200 million. How's the Port Authority of Greater Cincinnati involved in this, Bob? What's the connection there?
So Hamilton County, as the older ones of us know, paid for the Reds and Bengals stadiums in the 90s. That didn't go as planned. A lot more debt than they had been promised. A lot of sour taste left. So Hamilton County has not been very enthusiastic about overtures to own another stadium. So FC Cincinnati has approached the Port Authority as the possible owner of the stadium, and it would work for them in a number of ways. The Port is a big organization that could potentially handle a project of this scale, and they've got some tax-exempt authority that would make the project cheaper rather than doing it as a fully private exercise.
And that's also assuming that they build the stadium on this side, on the Ohio side of the river.
Yeah, I mean, they could do it that way in Kentucky, but because of the site they're looking at in Newport, they wouldn't need it. Kentucky has very generous TIF financing. Complicated vehicle. Maybe Jason could explain that more simply than I can. But basically, they recover a bunch of money through this, and the bottom line is that that tax incentive is so generous on that side of the river that they may not need the same sort of deal for the Port to take over and run it in Newport.
Yeah, you're talking about Jeff Birding, who was a former Cincinnati City Council member and a former Bengals executive, and he was involved with that 1996 sales tax deal. Is this something that he's keeping in mind as he goes through this whole process with FC Cincinnati?
Definitely. He came before our editorial board, and he said the only thing these two projects have in common is the word stadium, which might be stretching it a bit, he is fully aware of the negative reaction that the community has had to the previous deal, and they're trying to sell this as a lot cheaper, that there's a lot more investment from the private side, that it's this legacy project that they want to provide for the city.
So how many people do you think will cross the river to go to a soccer game? Because I'll tell you, my sister, who is madly in love with FC Cincinnati and goes to every game, has said to me, I will not cross the river
really?
To go to a game. Yeah.
That's funny.
So I wonder if that's a hurdle.
I want to approach this with a little bit of humility because the whole phenomenon is so unexpected for me. I'm a Gen X guy who did not – I have not been particularly a soccer sports fan in my life. I would have never predicted FC Cincinnati doing as well as it has. I don't know. I think the river has gotten more narrow over the years than when I was growing up, where we wouldn't have dreamed of going across the river for entertainment when I was a kid mm-hmm. to Covington or Newport. You know, now Newport on the Levee's been there for decades and a lot of restaurants and bars and Mainstross, et cetera. So I just don't know. I do have the sense that the team really wants it in the city of Cincinnati. I think if they could have their druthers, it would be West End.
But where's this head next, though, Bob? I mean, will there be a referendum on this like there was on the sales tax issue?
Yeah.
Or if Jason has a feel for that?
Go ahead, Jason.
No, there will not be.
Okay.
It's a word of authority right there.
Simple as that.
I mean, the other thing, too, I'd like to add to what Bob said was like the Port Authority's involvement, if it potentially gets involved. The thing is, yeah, they can do tax exempt bonds, but you still have to have a revenue stream to repay those bonds, and that's where stadium tax types of things come in. There are other people have done stories on this across the country. The economic development of stadiums certainly is a very hugely debatable issue, and does it generate enough business, even if you can put a hotel and youth soccer games there and big concerts or whatever, does it still generate enough money to repay the bonds? I'm very skeptical of that.
Well, Ann and Bob, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Cincinnati Thanks. Enquirer health reporter Ann Saker, WCPO economic development reporter Bob Driehaus. And coming up, how's that relationship between Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell and President Trump going these days? We will continue our conversation with Jason Williams, and Howard Wilkinson will join in. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with Enquirer political columnist Jason Williams and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell finds himself being targeted by some irate tweets from President Trump as of late. And what's fueling this?
It actually are comments that McConnell made here in Northern Kentucky on Monday.
That speech you gave in Florence?
Yep.
Okay.
To a Rotary Club. I counted. It was like 56 people that I counted in the room, not counting the reporters and McConnell. Howard can speak to McConnell much better than I can, but In the moment, it doesn't sound like a lot because McConnell is a very boring guy and
right.
he's, you know, very low key. But then when you go back and look at it, and his terms were, well, the president had excessive expectations were his quote, and that he had set all these artificial deadlines. And essentially he was intimating that this is a reason why we haven't, this is a normal process. we haven't gotten things done yet, but they'll get done. But the reason why it's such a big deal right now is because the president had this crazy agenda and didn't understand how Washington worked.
Yeah, and you're right about him. I mean, you know, you can sit there and listen to it, but then you have to go back later and look at your notes and say, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
He actually said something of substance here. And, you know, of course, Trump had to start tweeting at him and start criticizing him and, you know, say, you know, come on, Mitch, let's go, you know, let's get something done here. The difference between Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell is Donald Trump wants to be loved. He wants people to love him. That's why he's still holding campaign rallies 9 months after the election. Mitch McConnell doesn't care. All Mitch McConnell cares about is getting a legislative agenda through. Somehow, somewhere, he doesn't care how long it takes. He doesn't care who likes him or who doesn't like him. And these two are just totally different personalities.
And McConnell's not the kind of guy who's going to – I don't even know if he actually has Twitter. I forgot.
Has he responded or fired back in any way?
Well, he hasn't, but I just saw a story. A number of his Republican colleagues are starting to defend him against Trump's attacks and you know, saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, this is our leader. Our leader is a good one. You know, he knows what he's doing. We're going to get these things done. But, you know, basically telling Trump, stay out of it.
Yeah. And that was essentially what McConnell was saying Monday
but
in Northern Kentucky. Like, just essentially, like, chill out, Trump. Mm-hmm. We'll get this done, but you got to give it. And then he pointed out, he actually turned around and complimented the president because he said he agreed with a lot of his agenda.
Yeah.
And then he also pointed out that the Congress under Obama, when Obama was first elected, that they didn't get a lot of major things done until his second year. Obamacare and Dodd-Frank, he pointed out, were both done in 2010, in the second year of the Obama administration.
And he pointed out, too, didn't he, that Trump comes from a different world than these politicians do.
Yeah, he was – Yeah,
and he comes from a world where
he comes from the business world. Let's go.
You know, I say we're going to do this. We're going to do it. We're going to do it now. That's not the way legislation works. That's not the way a body like the United States Senate works. Certainly, we've learned if we've learned anything, and I don't think to a large extent Donald Trump understands that process, understands that legislative process.
What did you get a chance to ask?
Why would he?
Right. I mean, he's a rookie.
Yeah.
Politically.
Did you get a chance to ask Senator McConnell what he thinks of the president's tweeting?
He actually it's funny because he mentioned it in his speech. It was a 15-minute speech. He took questions for about 10 minutes from the audience. And he reiterated, and he said it before to reporters. And he said, I've told the president personally that I do not like his tweeting. I don't like it. I would prefer him not do it. And then, so I caught him quickly afterward, and I was building up to ask him I'd ask him two questions about Trump. And then my next question, he started to walk away out the door, literally, in the middle of the answering my second question. But my next question was going to be, are you going to look to separate yourself from or distance yourself from Trump? And I didn't get a chance to ask him that. But I'm sure it would have been
a very diplomatic
answer. Yes.
Yeah, I think he's diplomatic, too, because he says our relationship's good, doesn't he?
Yes, he said that. And interestingly, I think this will be interesting to see how this plays out because in the same speech on Monday, McConnell said, I don't see a path forward on repealing Obamacare. I'm ready to move forward. Trump certainly is not. Then you also have that McConnell's wife is a part of Trump's cabinet. Elaine Chao is the Department of Transportation secretary.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how all that plays into it, but it's interesting.
You know, Mark, you talk about is he a guy who's on Twitter? I just don't see Mitch McConnell sitting around 2 or 3 in the morning, you know, pouring out his most intimate thoughts about government and what we should be doing in the United States Senate on Twitter. That's just not him. That's not the way – that's not his style.
Is it fair to say in some ways he's the opposite of Trump?
He's very, the total opposite.
Total opposite, low-key, rather understated.
Right. I mean, yeah. they're totally different personalities. Doesn't mean they can't get along. Doesn't mean they can't work together on some things. But they're going to have to find some kind of middle ground, common ground, that'll bridge this gulf over, their styles.
Well, and Howard, too, I wonder how wise is it for President Trump to be criticizing somebody who's really an ally and who he's going to need in the future to get things accomplished?
Well, it's not very wise. I mean, he's got the United States Senate. These guys are worried about 2018. Many of them are in states that were won by Hillary Clinton or it was very close. And they have to be careful politically. They want to keep their job. They want to keep their majority. Their majority is not very large. Nope. They have 52 Republicans in the Senate right now, and they could very well lose control in next year's election. And Donald Trump would probably be wise to let Mitch McConnell handle that because he's proven in the past that he knows how to win. He knows how to win majorities, not big majorities, but majorities.
Has McConnell always been pretty – I mean, so he first ran for Senate in 1984.
Yeah.
Has he always been a pretty, anti-charismatic?
Yeah, that's him.
Even keeled, if you want to be diplomatic about it.
There was never a time where he was, like, running around wearing leisure suits or anything like that, doing disco. I mean, he was – he is what he is.
Do you remember the – didn't he have commercials when he was running against the incumbent where there was hound dogs?
Oh, yeah.
And the
hound dogs, yeah.
Running at – trying to chase this guy around.
Chasing the guy around, but you didn't see his face.
No.
It was good – it was good visuals. And he was as tough as nails. I mean, he was the kind of guy – and he always is, and he was in the last election against Grimes. The kind of guy that says, if you throw rocks at me – I'm going to throw boulders at you, and that's what he does.
He will cut you.
He will cut you without a second thought.
Yeah, he talked about – you were saying he's talking about moving on from repealing and replacing the ACA. Did he give any indications of where he thinks the Senate's going to head next on legislative issues?
He talked about tax reform this fall. That was the big one. And he talked about the balance or trying to balance the budget toward the as by the end of the year I can't remember exactly how he said it, but it was trying to balance the budget and tax reform or what he wanted to tackle.
Mm-hmm. Those are the priorities. Right.
Howard, can you give us a preview of what's coming up in Tales from the Trail? tomorrow at WVXU.org, Saturday.
Yeah, it actually will show up on the website at 5 o'clock in the morning if you want to get up real early on Saturday morning. But it'll still be there if you decide to sleep in. I don't want to give it all away, but it's about John Boehner and has to do with one of John's personal habits, which is smoking.
Tales from the Trail is outstanding. Give a shameless plug, Jason, for Howard.
Thank you, Jason.
You guys are fortunate to have us.
But no, it'll be entertaining, I hope. I hope you'll get a laugh out of it anyway.
Well, Jason and Howard, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Sure.
Thanks.
Enquirer political columnist Jason Williams and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. Coming up, Bruce Willis is back in town for his next movie. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
Agent Montgomery, they've hit another bank.
We're on it.
A $3 million donation to a charity. These guys are trying to make themselves look really good.
Are you suggesting that these guys are doing the right thing by leading me to a bigger fish?
7 of 16 representatives have accounts at Hubert's Branch.
What's the difference between a question and an allegation?
An allegation is the one you don't answer.
Yeah. You're crazy!
Cupid is still out there.
Everybody down!
Not everybody needs a gun to get things done.
That's from the movie Marauders, the last time Bruce Willis was in Cincinnati. Now he's back. This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Haney, and joining me now, WVXU Media Beat reporter John Kieswetter. John, good afternoon.
Hey, Mark. How you doing?
Good, thanks. So what's the movie, and who's going to be in this with Bruce Willis?
The movie's called Reprisal. They started shooting it Monday, and in it with Bruce Willis is a actor named Frank Grillo. You'd know him from the Captain America movies. He was Brock Rumlow, also known as Crossbones. The female lead is Olivia Culpo. She was Miss USA 2012 in the same pageant with A.J. McCarron's wife, Catherine Webb. And a guy by the name of Jonathan Shake, who was in Marauders with Bruce Willis back in 2015, which was shot here. And they surprised council with two guys from a reality series on Bravo set in Charleston called Southern Charm. And it's the two of their characters from the reality show, the people in it, Shep Rose and Craig Conover.
So what's the plot, John?
lots of gunshots.
So is this Marauders 2?
No. Well, anyway, Grillo plays a guy named Jacob. He was a bank employee. He's married to Christina, who's played by Culpo, and they have a diabetic daughter. And he suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder because there was a violent bank robbery at his bank that he couldn't stop. And then there's Jonathan Shake, who was also in, like I said, in Marauders, but he's also in Vice and The Prince, two other films that Willis has done with this same director, Brian Miller. And Jonathan Shake plays a guy who's a criminal behind a bunch of robberies. And after Jacob's wife and daughter are kidnapped, then Jacob follows this Jonathan Shake character trying to find him, and they go into what the movie company is calling a path of destruction. Essentially, the hunter becomes the hunted. We know that Brian Miller who's the director in town. He said he loved the architecture, and they spent the first two or three days shooting down at Yateman's Cove on the riverfront, Smale Park, Suspension Bridge. And he told us, as a director, I love the architecture. The Roebling Goods is in our finale scene. You have incredible architecture, and I really appreciate you letting us blow it up.
So we may see some icons, Cincinnati icons, destroyed in this movie then.
Computer graphics, CG
simulation, yeah.
Yeah. Just like, the Marauders was pretty violent, but there were some nice scenes of the city and some great drone shots overhead. My guess is we'll see a lot of the city and then maybe end up in flames or rubble.
How did Cincinnati end up landing this movie? What drew them back here?
Well, the producer, Randall Emmett, from the company Emmett Furla Oasis Films, this is actually the fourth film he shot here. He did Marauders in 2015. Last year, he did The Life and Death of John Gotti with John Travolta and Kelly Preston and Stacey Keach. He also did Inconceivable last fall. That was with Nicolas Cage and Nikki Whalen and a WWE wrestler named Natalie Eva Marie. And then he's back doing Reprisal. Earlier this year, he was shooting another film with Bruce Willis in the Cleveland area. And actually, he said he's applying for 8 more tax credits to shoot films in Ohio, although he said, I might only get 2 or 3 approved. So the tax credits are such a great deal. It lowers the budget so much. That's why this is his fourth major film shot here since fall of 2015.
How many movies is this over the past few years that have been produced here in Cincinnati? Not just his, but...
I can't tell you all. I know that last year, I think the number was 10 or 11. This is the third, this is only the early August, and this is the third major film. In February, Emilio Estevez was here shooting a film at the public library called The Public that had he was in it, and Alec Baldwin. And then in April and May, Robert Redford and Casey Affleck were in town, and folk singer Tom Waits, and they were doing a show called The Old Man and the Gun. They shot around Cincinnati. They were in Covington and Latonia and up in Hamilton, used a bunch of different storefronts that they could use to make it look like all different parts of America. And then there's Reprisal, which started this week. They made the distinction of saying, well, Frank Grillo is the star of the film. And I think the formula here for this production company, Emmett Furlow Oasis Films, is you bring in a big name like Bruce Willis, you shoot maybe two or three days, you shoot all his scenes, and then he goes away. So you got the big name, but really the star of the show, they said, is Frank Grillo. On Wednesday, that's when they were wrapping up shooting the finale, so that's why that you'd meet Willis here. My guess is that come this time next week, or maybe even early next week, Willis will be long gone, and it will just be the other principals shooting the movie.
So what parts of town are they shooting in?
They're supposed to do some around Cincinnati State. I think they're going to do some in over the Rhine. The first 3 days, they were at Yateman's Cove, Smale Park, the Suspension Bridge. That's about all I know at this point. I know the film Cincinnati, the Film Commission, doesn't like a whole lot of advance publicity because they don't want a whole lot of gawkers and onlookers. On the other hand, I think it's a website, Roadmap Cincinnati, I believe I've got that right, has been alerting because there's got to be street closures and people need to know when, you know, like the Suspension Bridge was closed Wednesday to shoot during the day. I mean, it would have been a problem yesterday because it was a Reds day game for all the people that might use a Suspension Bridge to go to the Reds game, but it was closed on Wednesday for filming.
So how has the city been treating the cast and crew?
The stars, the producers, the directors who come from out of town love it here. Randall Emmett of the production company said, you know, the restaurants and the hotels have been very generous. They love it here because, you know, if you're staying in a downtown hotel and shooting at the Suspension Bridge, what is that, a mile at most? You know, you're 3-4 minutes from the set. Whereas if you're shooting in L.A., and if you're in a hotel, wherever you are, you're an hour or two away from the set, and you're caught in all kinds of traffic. Brian Miller had made the point that, I believe it was him, who said, you know, if we're in New York or L.A., people get angry that we're blocking streets and we're in the way. But here, everybody's been really polite, very accommodating, and it's like we're welcoming heroes. It's like a big homecoming to come here. So
when did you say they wrap up their shoot? When did they wrap this up, John?
In 2 more weeks.
Okay. And do we know when this is going to release yet?
They're talking about an April release through a company called Lionsgate.
Yeah, it just seems like Cincinnati's reputation as a place where movie making is growing, isn't it?
It is. I mean, Kristen Swatman and Film Cincinnati does a great job. They handle all the needs. They anticipate the problems. They get the permits. They make it very easy to shoot a film here, and they've got a growing company base of the support, the techies, the equipment, the cameras, the grips, and the employees you need to staff it, local employees. So, yeah, she's done a great job, and like I said, 10 or 11 movies last year, 3 major movies already this year.
John, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. It was very fun.
WVXU Media Beat reporter John Kieswetter. You can find his columns at WVXU.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Denise Driehaus is only the second woman ever elected to the Hamilton County Commission. Now she plans to make the county more inclusive for women. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll discuss the newly created Commission on Women and Girls. And we'll get an update on Melodic Connections. Last August, the nonprofit's building was flooded. Now it's offering music therapy programs at its new home in Silverton. That's on Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.